I'm Brian Roth, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. About 20 miles outside downtown Austin, Texas, it's easy to forget you are a short car ride away from one of the fastest growing cities in the country. Sitting partially hidden in the middle of spacious farmland is one of the crown jewels of the modern U.S. beer scene, Jester King Brewery. Enthusiasts make the pilgrimage from all over, waiting in line to try some of the most beloved wild, sour, and spontaneous beers being made today, every one of them with a purpose of time and place. It's the brainchild of Jeff Stuffings, co-founder of the family-owned business and an advocate for all the ways making beer can be an intimate process. Plenty of wooden barrels and stainless steel comprise a modestly sized brew house at the farm brewery, but it's the ideas of what beer could and should be that have made Jester King such a popular brand among drinkers. And as you'll find out in this conversation, the process of what has taken Stuffings and his team to this moment in time, and what he hopes to achieve in years to come, is very much based on a connection to the land and people around him. This is Jeff Stuffings of Jester King Brewery. Listen in. So you just finished up doing a tour.
Yes.
And one of the last questions that you were asked was actually something that I was really interested in about too. The fact that you're doing the tours, which you had said is kind of a shared thing that you and other people do. What is it that you get out of being able to do that, to take people through the process and tell them about Jester King?
Yeah, I still like to do the tours. I mean, again, not all of them, I'm part of a rotation, but I like to do them to, I don't know, still see people's reactions when they drink our beer. I think it's, you know, easy. I mean, we do events, but it's easy to kind of be a little bit removed from the experience of people actually getting to drink them. So, I don't know, it kind of helps them keep a pulse on kind of, you know, where our customers' heads are at, and you know, are they? How's the experience of visiting here? And actually, it's not just about getting a chance to get people's reactions to our beer. It's also a chance to kind of see the reaction to this place, because this was never our intent when we opened, but it's become more of a providing kind of a beer destination place for people, because when we started, it was illegal to sell our beer beyond our tap room. Or sorry, in our tap room, it had to be distributed. And now we sell, you know, almost 70% of our beer right here at the brewery. So just kind of seeing, you know, keeping tabs on how the place runs on the weekends. You know, I'm here 5 days a week during the time of week we make beer, but then, you know, a lot of us go home on the weekends and don't get to experience, you know, what it's like for people to come out here and drink beer here. Mm. So
and it's clear, at least from hearing the very end of the tour, that the people who are on it are certainly getting something out of it. Passionate beer fans, I imagine, are very excited as well. I'm curious, the flip side of that, and you kind of alluded to it, what is it that you're getting out of it? What are some of the things that you've learned from doing this?
Yeah, I think by doing tours, I've kind of, I think I've become a better advocate for just mixed culture fermentation, beers that have a sense of place, beers that are a product of our local agriculture. You know, what we do is obviously, you know, very different than kind of, you know, beers that would be more carefully engineered, which I love. But kind of developing, you know, a vocabulary to kind of speak about these wild ales and mixed culture fermentations, and being able to kind of communicate why they're a little different than beers that are, you know, pure culture fermentations that are more designed to be more consistent. And so I think just kind of honing my skills through tours to be a better advocate for what we do and for the category as a whole is something I get out of it.
Tell me about the vocabulary. What is it that you've learned or had to adjust in order to make it accessible for anybody who might show up?
Right. I think, you know, you walk into, you know, the brew house and, you know, it looks like, you know, 100 or 1,000 other breweries, you know, with, you know, mash tun and kettle and, you know, cylinder conical fermenters and, you know, kind of helping people bridge the gap between, you know, equipment that is somewhat, you know, standard versus beer that's pretty significantly different than the way, you know, most beer by volume is made. So I think just you know, lately, and I'm always kind of, you know, tweaking my presentation here and there a little bit, but lately I think as more and more people have gotten into natural wines, just kind of explaining that connection to or crossover with the winemaking world, where, you know, just instead of using yeast that maybe is on the skin of the grapes, using yeast that is, you know, ambient in our environment or in our barrel room, or maybe on the skin of the other ingredients that we add to our beer, whether it be the fruit or various herbs or spices, and just kind of explaining like what a farmhouse ale is. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, you ask a brewer, what is a farmhouse ale? You get, you know, 10 different answers. And, you know, by volume, I would hazard that, you know, most farmhouse ale that's labeled that is probably a pure culture beer that has probably been, you know, force carbonated and, you know, is delicious to drink and wonderful, but I don't think is really necessarily like a reflection of place. And that's how I would, you know, define a farmhouse ale, a beer that's, you know, linked to the natural surroundings and, you know, has natural variation based on the environment. Something that isn't reproducible, something that has that, you know, connection to land. So I think just making the argument to people of how we define farmhouse ale and why it's important to us is important. So, you know, I just think, going back to why I do tours, I like to just have that opportunity to make that pitch, not every week, but, you know, a couple times a month at least.
Yeah. Why is it that you think using the wine language has been successful in terms of describing the beer?
Yeah, I'm not even sure that it has been yet. It's something it's somewhat fairly new to me, kind of using some of the wine language. But as it's kind of dawned on me that, you know, what we do is I think in a lot of ways closer to winemaking than I guess beer making, at least in the context of making, you know, let's say, you know, technically precise, you know, really squeaky clean beers. And, you know, what we do with, you know, using native yeast or doing, for instance, you know, fruit re-fermentations and fooder, punch downs, just allowing, you know, natural fermentation and then re-fermentation in the bottle take place. You know, we've kind of found just like on an industry friend level, we've oftentimes gravitated more towards, you know, other wild beer makers as well as just natural winemakers. And I think that natural kinship has kind of led me to kind of describe the beers in the context of not just wild beer, but also natural winemaking. So I don't know. I think just, again, kind of that kinship has kind of led me to try to, you know, use some of that terminology. Whether it's been successful, I'm not sure. I think, you know, the simplicity of winemaking is a good kind of analogy for the simplicity of wild ale making. I mean, on a microbial level, it's extremely complex, but on a procedural level, you know, it is so simple what we do. I mean, a winemaker, a friend of mine in the Hill Country, is fond of saying, like, our secret is there is no secret. And it's the exact same thing with us. I almost get a little bashful about when people want to, like, see how we do things, because, I mean, it's literally just, like, do a single infusion mash, you know, rack to oak, and then just see what happens. And then the blending is kind of hard to really, like, show or teach. That, I mean, it's just something that just takes time and experience to kind of develop that palate necessary for making good blends.
And one of the things that I think I hear often, whether it's a more intimate brewery like yours or even a larger scale one, when making wild sour, you know, whatever it may be, beer, the context of trying to sell it is very often told in ideas of education. We're trying to educate the consumer about what this is and why it's enjoyable and so on and so forth. And I'm, from the experience that you've had, and the way that maybe you're having these conversations and workshopping, you know, wine vernacular as well, what are the specific things that you found successful when talking about it in an educational way that is effective to a non-beer geek? So an average person who's coming in and you're trying to use this opportunity to educate and teach and get them interested.
Yes. So when it comes to that kind of platform to talk to people who aren't necessarily accustomed to what we do or even drinking beer in general, I would, you know, number one, kind of explain the connection to place and locality. As you know, I think people want to support something that is a product of where they're from. So I'll, you know, talk about, you know, how we have a connection with our local maltster and growers in the area. So kind of explaining how, you know, we're not something that, you know, is owned by some shadow corporation and, you know, has ingredients, not that they're bad ingredients, but ingredients from all over the world. You know, just explaining how this is local homespun business. And so that's part of the pitch of why, you know, and obviously that's not unique to us, but I mean, I think that's one of the things that people should aim to support. And then from there, I would say, you know, I try to use it as a vehicle to say, you know, this is something that is unique, you know, and in a world of just a lot of uniformity and repetition and just overall, just kind of, I don't know, almost repetitiveness. I think that, you know, things that are truly authentic are becoming increasingly hard to find. So also explaining just what goes into making our beer, whether it be, you know, raw well water, you know, local grains, aged hops from our barn, mixed culture fermentation, fruit from down the road and re-fermentation from there, and then bottle aging, just explaining how like a lot of like love goes into to making this. And then finally, I would also say, you know, and this is where I get a little bit more just like, or I should say a little less just trying to make a pitch to anyone, but more just presenting what we do and what we're into, and then ultimately asking you to just kind of accept or accept it or reject it, which would be this beer is going to be either very dry and bitter or dry and tart. There's going to be some kind of funky yeast flavors. There's going to be some kind of, you know, whether it be one of our fruit fermentations, some, you know, kind of wine-like notes, and this beer is going to be a little more probably effervescent through long-term bottle or keg conditioning. And very dry. And so, you know, ultimately, like that's kind of where it stops. Like we're gonna, you know, have a philosophy that we think is embracing. We're gonna have worth embracing. We're gonna have authenticity. But that product is just kind of take it or leave it. Really, it's kind of like what we're into, and we do such a small volume. We have the luxury of just being able to hold very true. We don't have to be the beer for everyone. And fortunately, there's enough people who support the philosophy that we're into that it creates a viable business.
How often do you get that rejection you're talking
about? Oh yeah, no, I one thing I like to do when I'm here on the brewery on a Saturday is, you know, just watch people's reactions when they drink our beer. And I'll definitely see people, you know, like wince or make faces and, you know, so it that happens plenty. So it's, but that's good in a sense. Cause I mean, obviously we don't want to serve bad beer to people, but it's going to be beer that I think is more, probably a little bit more challenging than they're used to if you're not all that experienced with it. And that's a good thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned ideas of authenticity, in which case not just beer, but I would argue in all sorts of consumer products and the way that culturally, I think people are thinking more about, what they buy and think about, is gaining importance. In terms of beer and the way that you approach what you do here, what does authentic mean?
I think authenticity starts with just openness and honesty about what you do. I mean, if you're just trying to make a really just sessionable pale ale that's just easy drinking and is really solidly made, I mean, that's authentic. I think, you know, if you're trying to ferment beer in barrels for, you know, multiple years and blend across time and bottle age that on, you know, horizontally and then just, you know, see where it goes. I mean, I think that is authentic as well. So I think just not trying, I mean, there's so many shortcuts that can be taken. There's so many, I don't know, ways to cut costs at the expense of, I think, the overall quality of the beer or whatever it may happen to maybe, you know, in the food and drink world, that I think just people who, I mean, everyone has to respect, you know, keeping the lights on in a business. I mean, we are a for-profit business. There's no hiding that. But I think just not putting that, you know, profitability at the peak. You know, let's make enough money to get by and let's make enough money to take care of our crew, our staff, and have them have, you know, good jobs. But then let's just be as inefficient as we need to be to make something that really is exceptional, and then be extremely honest with people about this is exactly how it's done. I mean, you see so many examples, and you know, I would never name names, but I mean, you see so many examples of just like, you know, ways that you can like really just cut corners, cheapen, you know, expedite, you know, follow the latest fads. That, you know, I think just holding true to your roots is a good example of authenticity.
So, what you were just talking about in terms of the process and ingredients, mm-hmm. that is part of how you define ideas of authenticity for Jester King. But there's also a case where the definition would go beyond that. I feel mm-hmm. that sure. part of what authentic is would also be kind of the story and the way and why you want to do the things that you do
yeah.
and why you use those ingredients and things like that. And the way that you think about it, perhaps now for the first time, as I'm trying to workshop this a little
sure,
bit, right?
Yeah.
How do you find that balance, or is there a balance in terms of the way that you think the idea of authenticity is important for Jester King?
I mean, I think what's most critical, and I can't help but just approach this a little bit from like a business perspective, is like I think that the currency of which, you know, we have, you know, viability as a business is authenticity. You know, I mentioned openness. I mentioned commitment to quality. And then I guess the third leg of that might be just, you know, standing for something. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a brewery that is, you know, outspoken about how we feel about whether it be, you know, beer laws or techniques. And I mean, we'd never denigrate, you know, someone else's, you know, technique. I mean, whatever works for them, that's great. But there are ones that we feel that if you're going to, you know, shoot for, let's just say, you know, farmhouse sale, it's probably better practice to do, you know, certain techniques or invest certain amounts of time into doing things. And so kind of being advocates for that kind of, approach, is part of it. And then also I would say, you know, a kind of piece of that in terms of standing for something is, environmentalism in our case, you know, being a brewery on the outskirts of Austin, which is, you know, growing by leaps and bounds. And, you know, we've been able to preserve, so far 58 acres, and we're working on preserving, if all goes well, another, you know, 100 or so, that will never get developed. It will only be for just people in the area to come out and enjoy. You know, that's important to us as well. You know, we're also part of like the Dark Skies Alliance to try to, you know, cut down on just like, you know, light pollution in the area. We're all, I mean, conservation is huge for us. You know, it got defunded, unfortunately, but like we're highly considering doing a conservation grant with the state, where basically we pledge like never to develop the land ever in exchange for grant money. And so, you know, if that becomes viable, we'll that's kind of putting our money where our mouth is ultimately when we say we'll never develop the land that we're acquiring.
Why is this stuff important to you?
I think it's important I think as kind of land goes away and more, you know, people come into various environments, I think, you know, having, you know, green space is becoming just very hard to come by. So, you know, obviously in terms of, you know, protecting nature is important, but I personally want to more just provide an experience for people that, that is unique and that is connected to nature and that ultimately serves the purpose of, you know, I think the true calling of beer, which is just a way to bring people together, for fun and conversation. I mean, you know, we don't have TVs and obviously we're not going to like ever would attempt to round up anyone's cell phones, but if I could like wave a magic wand and like make everyone's cell phone like vanish when they step on here and then, you know, they can have it back when they leave, I'd be in favor of that, just because I think, you know, beer is the ultimate social beverage and, you know, it has just a rich history of bringing people together. And so I think that's kind of our, you know, again, I'm not trying to sugarcoat anything, we're a for-profit business, but I think the higher calling is like creating a community of people in a environmentally friendly place.
How easy has it been for you to make sure that continues to be a front of mind thing for you?
I would say it's at the very heart of our mission. I mean, we've actually now 7 years in actually taken time to kind of, you know, do the kind of the business 101 stuff of actually like putting that to paper. And, you know, we have written like a mission statement and a vision statement and, you know, just kind of protecting the land, working in harmony with the land, working to conserve water has been something that's just been really important for us. It's just like good stewards, good neighbors. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of businesses, and I'm not talking breweries at all, but I think a lot of businesses will obviously like just sap resources until they're gone and just move on. You know, it's like I have little kids who like to read the Lorax, and like that's very much, I think, you know, something that happens in a lot of industries. And, you know, I think the first rule for us is like, you know, like do no harm. I mean, that's always been important to me. You know, we're a business, but like do no harm. I mean, that I think that's kind of one of the mantras we try to abide by.
Mm-hmm. That's applicable for you. And I think that having the opportunity to share that with the people who come here is probably a value that is shared and something that you can tell them. How is it that you try to make that idea, the do no harm, and think a bit broader with other brewers, other businesses? How are those conversations happening to try to make that more front of mind for others as well?
Yeah. And I would freely admit that at least on a personal level, I've not been great about going out to other brewers and trying to kind of foster that similar mindset. I would say, you know, internally here at Jester King is something we really have strived for pretty heavily through our staff, you know, who we decide to you know, have part of this organization and who we don't, and kind of helping to reinforce those values, like at least on a, you know, every quarter basis within our brewery. You know, we have meetings where we specifically go over like what we're about, what our values are, you know, why this is important to us. I think on a, you know, on a guild level, you know, there's, for instance, we're just a small piece of this. I think the Texas Craft Brewers Guild has done a good job creating workshops on sustainability, efficiency when it comes to brewing practices that aren't wasteful and are environmentally friendly. So I would say, you know, I wouldn't give ourselves too much of a pat on the back, but I would say the Texas Craft Brewers Guild has done a good job with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the ways that, again, you guys are putting your money where your mouth is, I know recently you had announced the hire of a farmer to take care of and expand the farming capabilities of Jester King.
Yeah.
Why was that something that was so important to do? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, sure. You know, as it comes to defining farmhouse ale and beer that's tied to place, I thought, you know, in terms of, you know, authenticity, I think is a sliding scale. And I think, you know, we've continuously made strides towards, you know, this unreachable ideal over the years. And I feel like the next step for us was, you know, farming here at the brewery to grow our own fruits, vegetables, herbs, spices, to a certain extent, our own grains, you know, hops. And then also, I think the second part of that is creating that kind of community hub. You know, 10 years from now, we're still going to be buying ingredients from abroad, whether it be Central Texas or in some cases, you know, much further than that. I mean, we're never going to make a beer that I think is like 100% just estate ingredients. I don't think that's realistic, but we'll have beers that have increasingly more ingredients that are from right here on the land, thus making our beer more authentic. And then I think we have the potential to create a kind of gathering place where people can come out, appreciate the land, learn from the land, and ultimately be able to take home the product that we produce from the land. I mean, I think, you know, having, you know, farmers markets and farm tours and ultimately having, you know, other types of fermented foods and beverages that are created from that farming is something that's, I would say just exciting to us. I mean, we've been making beer for 7 years, and, you know, I think there's a natural kind of, you know, even though we learn something new every day from beer, a natural desire to say, well, what's next? You know, what, I think going through our program of creating spontaneously fermented beers, which ultimately took like 5 years to do, was kind of a major focus of ours. And then once that program is now kind of, you know, established, it's kind of, well, what's next? I mean, what are we, what's the next kind of long-term project are we excited about? And ultimately, like, farming is it.
What are some of those agricultural products that you're most excited about that will be grown here?
And this is just kind of big personal preference. Some of my favorite beers we make are fruit re-fermentations with wine grapes. And I almost feel a little like cliche right now, because I know a lot of brewers right now are interested in you know, winemaking techniques and grapes. And I think, you know, that's no exception for us as well. So, you know, we have about 600 grapevines going in the ground this winter. Just a whole lot of just native stuff from wineries, cuttings from wineries in the high plains and out in the hill country. And we're gonna just do dry farming. So just like super minimally invasive on the land. We don't want to at all, you know, be a water hog out here. So we're gonna find stuff that you know, we're working with berms and swells to capture water and do dry farming here. And then yield is, it's not something we care about. That's kind of the beauty of it, is, you know, we don't need to hit certain numbers. We don't need to have a certain volume that's produced from it. We just will take whatever nature gives us and do the best we can to make, whether it be beer or wine from it. And then just, whatever it produces, it produces. Mm-hmm. It's a luxury. I mean, it's by saying that, like, we're not set on, you know, hitting a certain growth mark or a certain volume. It's just extremely liberating. I mean, granted, you got to get to a certain level where, you know, you're not just going to fail as a business and everyone loses their jobs, but it's liberating to know, like, we don't have to hit a certain mark or anything. We can just do what we enjoy. And to me, I think as soon as I realized that, like, the community and the friendships and the abilities to experience, you know, I think culture and community, really not just in Texas, but all throughout the world, like, that to me is all I could ever ask for. And when I get to that level, it's very liberating, because you don't need to achieve a certain level of profit. It's just, you can just be authentic and true to your craft and a good steward of the environment and part of a good community. And that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Forgive me if I misheard you. Did you say that there was the chance that you could be making wine, those grapes, or just using it within the beer?
Oh, both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Why are you excited about that potential? Doing something different.
I think, yeah, just all things fermentation. I think, you know, over the last decade, I mean, 10 years ago, I was drinking, you know, I was actually living in Chicago and, you know, Natural Light and Old Style were my go-tos. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with mass-produced lager. I always say that, like, there's nothing wrong with like mass-produced lager. If that's what you're into, that's fine. I mean, my only quibble with you know, the big companies is, you know, how they do business and how they affect beer laws and whatnot. But as far as just the product they make, you know, whatever, it doesn't bother me. So that's just a quick aside. But, you know, you go through this process of going, you know, getting into beer and then getting into craft beer and, you know, living in Chicago, you know, I was drinking, you know, I discovered, you know, Bell's and Founders. And then I ended up in Massachusetts for a period of time and discovered, like, Harpoon and, I'm trying to think what else, but anyway, just like, or Dogfish, you know, being on the East Coast and, like, really starting to discover that beer could be more than, you know, pale light lager. And then, going through the spectrum of just, like, just trying everything under the sun. And then ultimately, I think, you know, I think a lot of brewers go through this, is ultimately getting a little jaded and a little palate fatigued on beer. And then I feel like right now there's kind of like a pendulum swinging back towards just, like, simplicity and just beers that are just simple and easy to drink. And I think I personally find that exciting. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with experimenting with, you know, more of a culinary approach to beer. That's wonderful. But I think just, I think you kind of, you know, after a decade of doing this, both, you know, planning a brewery and then operating a brewery, it's kind of like, well, what are we excited about at this point? And I think the one kind of constant that runs through this all is we haven't gotten tired of fermentation. Like, fermentation is just still extremely exciting. And it's kind of, well, what other types of fermentation can we do here that would kind of pique our interest?
What's an ideal timeline for that? Just as things grow, you were talking about, and wait to see what it is.
Yeah. I wish it was going to be quicker, but, I mean, we're probably looking at like 5 to 7 years to before that will happen.
Playing with fermentation outside of just beer, how does that make you and other staff better at your jobs?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, we're not very experienced when it comes to fermentation outside of beer. So we're just starting to learn. But I think a lot of what we've seen so far is the same principles apply. I mean, we've, you know, technically it's a little illegal, but, you know, we've experimented with making wine like in the brewery, just like essentially homemaking wine. You know, technically we're not supposed to do that, but, you know, oh well, it's on tape now. So if they want to come and get us, they can confiscate our 5 gallons of wine. But, you know, it's been fun to, I mean, and this goes back to one of my, you know, previous things I said, like just the parallels are just so similar with, you know, how we've approached, you know, just home, quote unquote, home brewing of wine, you know, just allowing just, you know, time for full attenuation, you know, letting kind of natural acidity develop, letting a little bit of funk, you know, not worrying about it looking dirty. I mean, I think, you know, there's kind of in the wine world, you know, people, you know, filter and fine and that's okay. And then, you know, add like, you know, like mega purple to get that like perfect color. And they'll then, you know, completely just, you know, sulfite the hell out of it to just make something that's never going to change. And, you know, I think, bring it much closer to what we do is I find this is where kind of like, again, like the natural winemakers and beer makers kind of meet, is it's just like the minimalist of it, process of it, like mash the grains, racked oak, let it go, crush the grapes, racked oak, let it go, blend and bottle and in some cases re-ferment. I mean, it's just so simple, like, I think that's where part of the excitement lies, in that, like, we think we could probably do this because it's more of just like coaxing nature in a certain direction, not trying to master it.
And you alluded to this a little bit before as well, that you're not the only one who's thinking about wine in terms of what it is as a beverage and perhaps also how it can improve your own skill set as a brewer. Is there something in particular that you've noticed or had come up in conversation with others in terms of why you feel now is a time when those conversations may be happening more often?
I'm not sure why they're maybe happening more often right now. I think there's some of that kind of natural fatigue that I mentioned that have led people to kind of experience other things. But I think it's no surprise that like some of the brewers that we're most impressed by and feel kind of the closest like kinship with kind of have come from wine backgrounds. You know, I think of like, you know, like Corey at Side Project and Trevor at DeGarde, and, you know, even though, you know, just in a vacuum, I mean, I'm not obviously a fan that they're owned by AB now, but like Walt at Wicked Weed, I think all of them come from a winemaking, or at least not, even if they weren't in the industry, like I can tell like a lot of their background comes from, you know, either making or serving wine, or at least just being, you know, wine nerds. And I think that it's not as surprising that some of those brewers and blenders that we kind of really gravitate towards as just fans of what they do kind of have that kind of winemaking background, or at least interest.
GBH is partially underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with for our Coming to America series. Guinness began brewing, and never stopped, at St. James Gate in Dublin in 1759, and has been shipping beer to America since 1817. And recently, they celebrated their distribution to the U.S. with their 200th anniversary export stout. And we've just taken on New Belgium as an underwriter as well, who will be bringing us focus on the evolving world of wild and sour, as drinkers around the world seek out new beer experiences that increasingly occupy a space in our lives once reserved for wine. How do we talk about these beers, buy and sell them, integrate them into new bar and restaurant concepts? We'll be publishing stories in that vein shortly. And of course, we are supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an export. In the US, we have the Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, Sound Growler Brewing in Tinley Park, Illinois, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, and then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa. They all support us through their monthly Pro Tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. So, in my mind, the way that I think that you're talking about this raises this very interesting, and maybe not a Venn diagram, but this kind of funny and fitting situation where the kind of beer, or in this case, fermentation that you like to do, is not up to you. You're kind of there shepherding it along, whether it be beer or wine, and there are so many variables that can change it every step of the way. And in that regard, it's a little bit of luck and also skill to know when and what to do. What makes you good at your job?
in my personal case, it would be just, I think, putting together a good team of people. I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned my friend Walt a moment ago, and, you know, he said ultimately at the end of the day, like, you're buying a brewer's palate. Because, I mean, we make a lot of bad beer in what we do. And, you know, I think the discipline we have is not to release it. And I think, you know, we develop good palates. I mentioned, you know, a wine influence on that. But I would say, you know, we've had the benefit of, you know, being part of the Shelton Brothers Network, and we've had just wonderful access to a lot of these old world brewers that have inspired us tremendously. And I think just drinking through so much of their beer, getting a chance to talk to these people. I mean, I remember when the first Shelton Brothers Festival happened in 2000, I think it was 11, in Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, it's the first time I got to talk to, you know, Yvon DeBates and Jean Vinois, about like how they make their beer and or Daniel Thierrier and just trying to just soak that all in terms of what, at least, you know, and everyone's got different opinions, but what, you know, they consider to be, you know, good drinkable beer. And I think, you know, we're an American brewery that has very heavily influenced from the European scene, both in terms of, you know, wild ales and, you know, with the traditional lambic producers, as well as beers that are just like very simple and dry and bitter and easy to drink. Like, if you ask us what are some of all time most influential beers here, it would be beers like, you know, like De La Centeris Bulba and Durant XX Bitter, just things that are like just dry, bitter, and super, super drinkable. So I think, you know, we've had a lot of good mentors. We've now, throughout 7 years, have had the benefit. I think, just to be perfectly honest, I think we were a little lucky in that we came into this as fairly novices and came in 2010, when I don't think the market was as extremely competitive, where we had time to kind of figure out, you know, what we were doing and how to make beer that we felt was up to our standards. So, you know, we could get by with like dumping. And I think, you know, 2011, we like dumped half our barrels just because, you know, we just could not figure out how to get, you know, fermentation to kind of head in a good direction. And, you know, we started out doing, not to go on a tangent, but we started off doing what's sometimes known as like the Vinnie method, where you like ferment clean with a pure culture and then pitch isolated cultures of like Breton bacteria going into barrel. So we did that for like the first 2 years. And then ultimately we decided to develop a mixed culture by blending strains of Saccharomyces and then yeast capture experiments and cool ship inoculations, blending it all together and letting that just change and develop over time and kind of coaxing it through variables like time, temperature, hopping rates, stainless steel versus oak fermentation. So I think just starting off with a really good palate, having a few years where, you know, it wasn't, you know, extremely competitive out there, we kind of figure out what we're doing. And then ultimately just having the discipline to dump bad beer. And then that discipline only became even easier to have it when we could start selling beer on site here at the brewery, because that essentially doubled our margins overnight. And so that just created even more leeway just to be super patient with stuff. No, I mean, I think good beer making is really just a want to. I don't think there's any secret. All the information's out there. Any brewer will tell you exactly what they do. I mean, 99% of them will. So I think it's just having the patience and discipline and developing your palate.
What's the best mistake that you've made?
Oh,
Oh, man.
Jeez. I can't think of any ones that ultimately were came out
so,
to me.
So in talking about kind of that process for you just now, you know, starting out from the question of what makes you good at your job and talking about the patients and where you're finding those learning experiences. 2011, you had to dump half of what you made, that being ultimately something that taught you what not to do or a different way to do things along the way. Beer, whether you're tasting it or you're making it, it's very much, it's trial and error. You don't know if you're going to like something until you taste it. You don't know if something's going to work just as you want it to unless you actually do it. And along the way, whether it's these wild successes or massive failures, there are still things that you learn from them throughout the process. And thinking about it in that context, is there something that does, maybe it's that 2011 example again, but is there something that stands out in your mind that really helped to change the way that you think about what you or others here do in terms of making your beer?
Sure. I think one thing that we've kind of, some of the biggest changes we've made over the years is kind of how we use hops to kind of dial in acidity in our beer. I mean, I think, you know, we get, and I mentioned this on the tour earlier, like we get called, Jester King, you know, that they're a sour beer maker, and that's fine. That doesn't necessarily bother me, but you know, we really just don't do acidity for acidity's sake. You know, I see, you know, acid in beer is kind of a part of an overall cohesive whole, the same way, you know, an acid note in a dish would create like a harmonious balance. So we started, I would say, off adding, you know, way too much hops to a lot of our beers early on, where, you know, transitioning from home brewing to professional brewing and just seeing how, you know, recipes, 5-gallon recipes on the malt side would scale up pretty well, but on the hop bills just did not translate. And then also we made the mistake, I would say, of with our aged hops, using hops that had not been as fully aged as they needed to, and then also using some pellets, which still kind of retained some of their bitterness at their core, even after, you know, years of aging. And so I think going through that experience of making beer that was a little, I think, too bitter, helped shape kind of how we would use fermentation or kind of use hopping rates to affect fermentation. So now I think we've gotten pretty good at being able to kind of add, you know, a certain amount of hops that we know will translate into kind of a certain amount of acidity when it comes to the finished beer. And then we can kind of manipulate that through the blending process. So yeah, I think over hopping has indirectly taught us how like our mixed culture behaves.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
I'd say we knew right away that like some of the beer was too bitter, like very quickly, but seeing its impact on fermentation was something that took, you know, a good kind of 2 to 3 years to let play out.
Is that frustrating?
Yeah. It's frustrating because, you know, in being here in Texas with spontaneous fermentation, you know, we get this little narrow window and we can only do, you know, 8, 10, 12 batches a year with the amount of cold weather we get, and then also the amount of space we have, which isn't a lot. So you only kind of get, you know, one bite at the apple every, you know, a little, you know, 10% of the year. And so you kind of have to wait to the following year to kind of make tweaks. And then you need that time to also evaluate how some of the tweaks you made 1 year play out over time. So it's definitely an exercise in patience and seeing kind of mistakes amend themselves over the course of like 2 to 3 years can be, you know, a little frustrating. Mm.
You had mentioned the connection of the literal word sour and acidity. If there's a challenge in using specific vernacular to describe your beers, because I would imagine that what you coax out of it, out of the range of beers you make, runs the full gamut of flavor opportunities. But even still, whether you're a beer enthusiast or someone who's maybe not familiar, there's a very limited scope of words that are used to describe what that is. I don't know if you like the word sour. It certainly maybe has its very specific points, but how is it that you try to select or use these particular ways to describe these descriptive, whether it's sour, wild, yada, yada. Yeah. How does that play into the way that you talk about your beer?
Yeah, it's difficult, and I think, you know, one of my frustrations is it takes a little bit more, I think, explanation to truly appreciate, you know, what it is we're striving for, and you know, not a lot of people are willing to take that time to kind of go, you know, a layer or two deeper into the process. So just like kind of on a quick, you know, quick and dirty just explanation, it is a challenge. I mean, to me, I always refer to us as, you know, we make farmhouse ales. I mean, that's I never refer to us as a sour beer maker, you know, and even that, you know, what is a farmhouse ale? I mean, yes, hearing farmhouse, it conjures up, you know, rustic images, and I think that's a piece of the puzzle. But I don't think there really is kind of like a silver bullet, if you will. I mean, as far as sour itself, I don't think it's unhelpful. I think, though, it kind of preconditions people to kind of look for a single component of the flavor profile, which, you know, again, I mean, it's almost, you know, I've heard, you know, I think it was, Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn saying, like, you know, a chef doesn't, or maybe it was Sam from Dogfish. I can't, one of those two, you know, rock star brewers there. They're saying, you know, a chef doesn't go out and just say, like, I'm going to make like the saltiest dish possible. Like that's, and we feel similarly, like we're not here to make like the most sour beer we can. To me, that's pointless. You want beer that's drinkable. I mean, that was one of the things I was beating to my head as a home brewer, like make your beer drinkable. Like if you have one glass and you're not excited to drink another, then it's not a drinkable beer. And so I think based on that, you know, it's kind of pushed us towards not really referring to our beer as like sour. So, I mean, why I've come around more recently to kind of, you know, just kind of settling on, you know, wild. And granted that, in my opinion, I've said Croncherry to this in the past. I'm being a little hypocritical here, but I don't think that necessarily implies it has to be a spontaneous fermentation. You know, I think just anything that's kind of beyond, you know, a monoculture can effectively be a wild beer. I think, you know, mixed fermentation is becoming something that's a little bit more ubiquitous in the industry. And I think that more and more beer drinkers are realizing the difference between like a, you know, pure culture fermentation versus a mixed culture and what that does to beer. So I kind of, I mean, I've been, you know, saying either mixed culture or mixed fermentation. I mean, we've been saying it for since the beginning, but I think I've been kind of using that phrase more and more often.
The opposing forces for this, and I think you kind of touched on it a little bit there too, is both a word proper to describe the process, which is accurate and true, versus using that word and knowing it should or could conjure a specific thing in somebody's head, which is not easy to find that middle ground.
Yeah.
And so using something, so like you're saying, mixed fermentation, mixed culture, are those words appropriate for someone who's completely beer 101?
I think they take a little bit more. I think those words, that phrase would be probably lost in someone who is just super novice. They may know that beer has yeast and it's a product of fermentation, but I think it takes that little bit more explanation. You know, I always like to try to, and granted, I have a captive audience to do this, which is great, but on my tours, I like to just remind people that, you know, these classic styles that you enjoy today, I mean, your English mild centuries ago was not a pure culture beer. I mean, it was, there were not sanitation procedures capable of producing pure culture, nor scientific technology capable of producing pure culture fermentation. So these beers, like anything, they would be, you know, quote unquote clean when they were young, but, you know, they would start to sour. I mean, they would start to spoil after so long. So, you know, I think one thing that's fun to challenge people is like this, you know, this quote unquote sour brewery that we are, like, you know, we serve a lot of beers that will serve them relatively young, and they're dry and bitter, and they're not sour at all. And so, I think, I mean, again, to kind of get back to your question, I think, you know, it takes a little more explanation that, you know, mixed culture fermentation is something that's always been there, and that pure culture fermentation is kind of a more modern phenomenon, really, in just the last 100 years or so, to really take beer to an industrial level. And I don't mean at all to suggest that beers that with, you know, are fermented with a pure culture are industrial beers. There are obviously thousands of examples that are not. But I mean, what really was the purpose of pure culture fermentation? I mean, it was to be able to scale up beer making, because otherwise, you know, you couldn't put these beers in a pack, bottle or whatever, and ship them all over without, you know, pasteurization or pure culture. They would start to, you know, spoil very quickly. They didn't have a long shelf life. And so, you know, reminding people that this is not some aberration. This is really beer at its roots.
This connects, I think, very closely to one of the things I dare say, I guess, a mantra that I think I hear and read from you a lot. You reference beer in terms of time and place.
Yeah.
And the importance in why that makes it special. Can you explain a little bit about why that has become something that means so much to you, thinking about it and describing it in those words?
Yeah, so I think, you know, an authentic farmhouse ale is in many ways something that is connected to time and place. You know, I think, you know, most, you go to the grocery store and, you know, most products there are, have some type of either ingredient or process put upon them that will make them, you know, shelf stable or at least have a very long shelf life and therefore something that can be kind of scaled up and mass produced. And I think, you know, the markets kind of dictate that people want, you know, consistency and predictability. I think, you know, you start to reach a ceiling when, you know, people get a little unnerved when they're opening something and it's maybe a little different every time. And so, but fortunately, you know, for some of the reasons I mentioned before, we can kind of exist outside of that machine and really just focus on just stuff that's, you know, made on our scale here. And that, you know, it has that uniqueness. I mean, one of my favorite things when I travel and going to a brewery is I want to taste something that could only exist here. I mean, I you know, I love IPA and to me, IPA is like Catholic mass. It tastes like, it's like the same every place I go and they all taste the same to me. They're all delicious, or like by and large, they're all delicious, but nonetheless, you know, they're not unique. I want to taste something that is unique to place, and whether that's ingredients or processes or just even a brewer's palate in how she or he makes their beer. Like that connection to like place and time is, it's just what I enjoy. And I think it's the most meaningful thing. I mean, someone can, there's a lot of credit that should be given to someone who can take a classic style and make it spot on consistently. That's not easy to do. And I would never want to denigrate that. But like brewers can kind of coax something out that's a little bit beyond that, that's a little more thoughtful and captivating. I mean, that's part of the fun and enjoyment. And I mean, at the end of the day, that's a huge part of what beer should be about.
How do you do that?
Oh, I would say, you know, we just try to be good stewards to, you know, the microflora. Make connections with the agricultural community in our environment, or in our area. You know, our maltster, our miller, the farmers in our area, the fruit growers, and then just kind of be, just don't mess it up from there. Just kind of be respectful of the ingredients and just not try to have too heavy of a hand. Not try to put, you know, too. I mean, there is a human element. Like I'm sure if it were a different cast of characters with a similar philosophy, the beer would be different. So there is that human element, especially when it comes to blending and recipe development. But I think really just staying out of the way.
In terms of the beers that you guys make here, and the time and place that describes them, to take that idea and expand it a little bit, where do you see Jester King fitting in within the time and place of Texas beer culture and the Texas beer industry right now?
Yes, it's funny. I think beer years are almost kind of like dog years. The scene changes so fast. I mean, when we were, we felt like, you know, a super kind of newcomer, a little bit kind of like tiptoeing into, you know, other people's space here, like a little bit of an interloper coming in 2010. Like I felt there was kind of like an older guard that I was, you know, a little intimidated by. And, you know, I think we were the 12th active brewery to open in 2010. And, you know, now there's over 250, where it's still kind of weird, to have, you know, brewers like say, oh, you know, we were heavily inspired by you, like to open a brewery. And it's bizarre, really. I mean, we feel like we're just still, you know, figuring out what we're doing and, you know, just kind of getting going. And to be, you know, thought of as like one of the more, established breweries in Texas, it's just weird and kind of surreal.
So here's the strange situation that is the reality. You were referring to meeting with Garrett Oliver and Sam Calagione, who you called, I would agree with you, the rock stars within the industry in terms of brewers. You are very much a rock star, as you're pointing out to other people as well, the way that you've built Jester King and created a new way, or enhanced and changed and given a new platform for people to think about this kind of beer more as an inspiration to others. Compliments are hard to take, especially when you always feel like you're trying to strive to do better yourself, right?
Right.
All of that together, how does that make you feel?
Yeah. It's a good feeling to know that, you know, to have the respect of our peers is just huge. And I mean, when we go to beer festivals and have people just say they, you know, really think highly of what we do and have gotten, you know, some inspiration from it, is just immensely rewarding. It still just blows me away. Cause you know, I still feel like I have one foot just in the homebrew store in my garage brewing, you know, especially cause what we do is just so simple that like, I don't like know a lot of the, you know, the brewing, like professional brewing equipment or terminology. Like, you know, we just like mash grains and just add a mixed culture to it and see what happens. And so yeah. It's in a way it's bizarre. Cause like, I'm like, I don't even know that much about brewing. So like, yeah.
Well, and keeping that in mind, and you've given plenty of examples as we chatted of the way that you're trying to find new ways to approach the beer that you make and just think about beer. What is it, one of those things you wake up in the morning gets you excited? What are some of those things that you are excited about when you come here, you know, 5 days a week to put in work?
Yeah. It's kind of shifted over the years, really. It's definitely started out with the beer. I mean, I got into this industry because I wanted to make beer, experiment with flavors, to see where fermentation could take us. I really wanted to see if we could do some of the styles that were being made by brewers like Jolly Pumpkin and Russian River and Allagash and Cantillon, and seeing if they would even work in Texas. I mean, we definitely had some pro brewers say like, I don't think that'll work in Texas. So There was a little bit of element to see like, can we do this? So trying to just make good beer was just a huge motivator for a long time, because, you know, literally going from the homebrew ranks, I mean, I don't think we were putting out, you know, bad beer from day one, but I mean, there was definitely a learning curve, and I think our beer's gotten, you know, progressively better over the years. But nowadays it's kind of shifted to the people element. I mean, what I'm most excited about these days walking into work is actually trying to create a culture and organization that, you know, runs well, where people feel, you know, liberated to be themselves, to, you know, I kind of try to steer us in a certain direction, but then really have people just take the initiative themselves to reach that goal. So, you know, actually learning, I mean, you would think, you know, so technically what we did was we opened a business, you know, back in 2010. I mean, that a business that makes beer, but I would say like zero thought went into, you know, how do you run a business? It was all into like, how can we make great beer? And if we just do that, you know, it'll take care of itself. And actually, to some extent, I think that proved to be true. But now, you know, 7 years in, it's like, how can we really be a great business? Like, for instance, I mean, this kind of sums it all up fairly tidily. You know, 7 years ago, our biggest inspiration out of Michigan was Jolly Pumpkin. Today, our biggest inspiration out of Michigan is a company called Zingerman's, which is started out as a delicatessen and now has all these kind of like fermentation related businesses. And I think really has like an ethos that fits with what we want to do. So being inspired by like other organizations that treat people well, treat the environment well, make quality stuff and provide for their communities is like so much more exciting these days than actually making beer.
Well, I'm excited to see where that inspiration takes you. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Oh, sure, Brian. Thank you. Yeah. Of course.
Thanks for listening this week. Over on the Good Beer Hunting website, Johnny Garrett travels to Norway, where he explores how the government's tax rate on alcohol, the second highest in the world, has encouraged the hobby of homebrewing, telling stories of locals and the surprising, or perhaps not necessarily so, find of a New England style IPA. We also provide some insight into the market of non-alcoholic beer, where, believe it or not, 12 different brands sold more than $1 million each in 2017, including Busch's non-alcoholic brand, which sold almost $26 million, the same amount of dollar sales in IRI channels as Boulevard Brewing. And with Chicago's uppers and downers happening just recently, the fervent few talk specialty coffee. Do our supporting members learn extraction techniques, roasters, and brewing methods in the same way they devour info on brewers, yeast strains, and hopping processes? If you want to join the fun and become part of the fervent few, check out goodbeerhunting.com/fervent few. As part of the community, you get access to a host of perks, in addition to sharing your voice with those of us on the GBH editorial team. We're so thankful for the support, encouragement, and inspiration of the fervent few and what they offer beer lovers too. Thanks to all our readers and listeners who make Good Beer Hunting a part of their routine. If you missed out on the Chicago uppers and downers, head over to goodbeerhunting.com/events to find tickets to the next event held in London on May 19th. That's it for this week. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.